And my family's from the Santa Cristo Mountains in Colorado in the Americas. Just so you know where I'm from. And today I titled this Tasting History. So this is a new project that I'm starting, but I just totally feel has already been beaten to death because I wrote a DECRA about it.
Did you say Asian today?
Beaten. But maybe also beaten. I'm going to put a timer on myself.
I can tell you.
But you'll electrocute it.
So I thought what I'd do is I just share some stuff that I've found so far in this vein, and then I talk about some of the various approaches that I'm going to take, maybe, in this project. So I can't really show any works or any result, anything, but it's just kind of new findings. And I'll just let the Lemba spread kind of speak for itself. But so I'm working on this substance right now called hardtack. I'm working on hardtack, Anzac biscuits, and fry bread, which I won't be talking about much, but I'll talk about maybe at the end. So if you want to try a piece of hardtack, that's in the middle. And this is like this gives you a sense of it. It's
like that. Enjoy.
Yeah, that's good.
Just keep that's too body.
So, you know, you don't have to take anything, but and like this kid. So I like a souvenir to the hardtack. No, you can't do that.
Can you actually buy it?
Really, no.
What am I going to do
with
it?
So hardtack is what people would eat on very long ship voyages. Please take it.
Right.
So hardtack is usually baked twice, and the idea is that you get rid of all the water, and that allows it to be preserved for. No, you can't do that. So typically, people don't eat hardtack like straight. They would like take their rifle maybe and like hit it and pull it through. And then you put it into like a soup or a broth or your tea or something. So here's a website for it. And there are actual people, I'm sure, here in Australia, but in the US too, who call themselves preppers, who are like waiting for the end time. And they're stocking up so that they'll be able to eat like their survival rations after the apocalypse. So this is a recipe from Urban Survival Site, How to Survive in the City When Disaster Strikes. And they have something called bug out bags, which is like all your prepper stuff in one place so that you can just be, there has one. There's also this recipe from the Australian War Memorial about for the Anzac tile. And this is kind of a soft core recipe because it uses milk powder, that's kind of a wimpy ingredient in the space. And also it has self-raising flour, and those things make it less they're less durable than the ones without that. So that's kind of a less hardcore recipe. So here's a really old one. This is in Denmark. It dates from 1852. And it's like doing fine. So here's the Jacka Bakery in Plymouth, and I've totally been here and talked to them and looked around their kitchen and stuff, and they live above it, and it's super cute. So they supplied the hardtack biscuits for the Mayflower.
Wow.
And they're still in business. They're the oldest bakery in the UK. But hardtack is more than edible. It's also like an inscription device. So here's someone writing a letter on it, and people just put a stamp on it and send it. Like without any covering, you know? There's one with a stamp. And then here's one where it's been turned into this like elaborate photo frame. And so this guy, he's in Ohio in 1865, and right around that same time, the Navajo were deported from their land and made what is called the
long walk, which is a really, really long walk to a really horrible place with no capacity to make, to like harvest any good food or eat well. And they ended up living off of rations that were flour, lard, sugar, raisin agents, salt. And from those rations, they made fry bread, which maybe you've had. If you haven't, you should. It's delicious. So you can eat this at like any powwow in the United States. Powwows are like big gatherings of First Nations peoples from all different tribes, but it started with Navajo. So the fried bread is a really ubiquitous food. It's probably the only food that all First Nations people in North America have in common. You make something called an Indian taco out of this. So you just put whatever you put in a taco, but you put it on that. And it's like soft and wonderful. It's like the opposite of a ship's biscuit. So what I'm after, these are just an introduction of the substances that I'm looking at and the recipes I'm looking at. So what I'm interested in doing in this project is thinking about how we taste specific histories when we eat certain things. So there's been a bit of work done on the Anzac biscuit about how Anzac biscuits are a culinary memorial, that we think about the war dead by eating them, and that perhaps even by eating the Anzac biscuit, we're reenacting some kind of war experience. Anzac biscuits weren't called that when they were initially sent to World War I soldiers, but people here had to figure out a way to send a baked good that would last for the ship's voyage, which was really long, 6 months. And they came up with Anzac biscuits because they are, they don't have some of the stuff that makes a biscuit spoil, like they don't have eggs in them, for example. So these last for quite a while, and they ended up being kind of reinscribed after World War I. There's like a myth, like a mythology of the Anzac biscuit, that it happened during the war and that people sent them and called them Anzac biscuits. But what people were more likely actually living on in some of those situations was something like this some of the time, not all the time, but some of the time. So this is the Anzac pile. And there have been, Tony Love, who's an Adelaide food critic, did a taste test of this where he made the Anzac pile recipe and tried to eat it. And then he ended that by saying, oh, come on, someone make me an Anzac biscuit, because I can't handle this, because we wanted that to sweeten this. So I'm looking at how we taste like a war reenactment through the Anzac biscuit. Hardtack is really interesting to me because this substance is really what made colonial conquest possible. Like all of those long ship voyages were possible because of this. This is what people ate when it got like really bad for the end. It's not that people lived on this. Like you shouldn't get the impression this is like all you had to eat, but it was what was the staple at some point on a long ship's voyage. So in some ways, wheat and this kind of substance has established a taste baseline that is very similar, I think, to the way we grow wheat. So it's like a mono taste, or like a monocrop, but a mono taste. And people don't really talk about the taste of wheat. It's kind of bland. It's like people don't really describe it much, but this supposed like non-flavor has colonized a lot of the world. So I think it's worth paying attention to why this is the maybe the baseline, no taste, bland taste of a contemporary Western diet. And I'm speculating that with fry bread as well, there's a way in which we're tasting, there's a taste of suffering of deported, dispossessed people from their land when we eat fry bread. And so we're tasting that history very actively when we eat this. Some people have a really spiritual connection to fry bread. Somebody says of fry bread, Cynthia Detter-Pineda writes, to some, fry bread is a sacred tradition. It is to be consumed by the people until the earth has again become purified. Fry bread is really controversial in First Nations culture because it's so bad for you, and there's a lot of health problems and reservations and fried bread isn't helping with that like at all, because it's like deep fried bread. And so people are eating this and it's really kind of bad for you, and yet it's like the one food that really has a cultural connection across so many tribes. So I don't think fried bread will ever stop, like people are going to be eating this forever. And it's a way of connecting to this very specific history around dispossession and exploitation and being removed from your land. So fried bread is also a specific history to taste, but it's also got this decolonizing potential, because even though it's got its roots in these military rations that were eaten under pretty trying circumstances, there's a way in which contemporary ingestions of fry bread are making connections more than kind of wallowing in those histories. And there's also a way in which Anzac biscuits were pretty important for the formation of the Australasian identities, especially of women, who weren't really involved in the kind of history, like war history identity formation that happened during World War I. So there are all of these ways in which we taste history when we are eating biscuits, especially. So I'm focused on biscuits. And yeah, that's pretty much the project. So some of the offshoots of the project are, one, I'm interested in this research from Hannah Lendecker about nutritional epigenetics, and that's the idea that we can change our genetic makeup by what we do after after our birth, so what we do, what we eat especially. So there's this conception she has of food as exposure. So there's like a food environment, a nutritional environment that we live within. And the questions I'm interested in are very speculative, but are something like, what does it mean when our sort of settler colonial ancestry has been exposed to foods like this? And is there a way that, like, if our bodies have become this, like, what can we do? How can we manipulate that nutritional environment somehow, or change it? And I think that we might even look at things like gluten intolerance as maybe a that precarity of wheat and gluten is sort of an environmental shift. Like a nutritional environmental shift, and that might be a symptom, like a kind of bowel irritating symptom of decolonization. So there's that thread. And I'm also interested in wheat as a companion species. So that's maybe the only thing I've really properly written up from this so far, is an essay in an environmentalism's issue of feminist review about thinking through wheat as a companion species. Most companion species are not plants, by and large. But I think that wheat really qualifies as such a companion species based on how humans have been domesticated by wheat just as much as we have domesticated it as a crop. Amory Mole, who I mentioned in my abstract, tells this really great story. Her dad told her the grain joke. And the grain joke is that there's an extraterrestrial looking down on planet Earth and observes that clearly these big fields of crops are in charge and there are humans that tend to them. And then the humans save like a couple of grains at the end of each cycle for themselves to eat, but really they're mostly serving the fields of grain, and that the grain is actually in control, you know, of the planet. And that's got some merit to it, I think. So there's this question about how we domesticate one another, ourselves, and our companion species. And then I had a third thing. I don't remember. But those are the two big ones I want to work on first, is the nutritional epigenetics thing and the companion species thing. So I hope that you find a creative way to ingest your fur cap. You can also just keep it as a souvenir, and I'll add that I made this about 6 months ago. So it's lasting quite well. It's been in a plastic bag, which is the prep
tougher recommendation to pack it for long-term storage in a plastic bag.
Do you want us to send you photos? What happens to it?
Oh, yeah, I have a lot. Yeah, I've distributed this at a couple of talks. So I have a lot of this in the world, like doing things and going places. So, all right, that's all I've got.
Thank you.